Dead and buried. Dead and buried.
Just where I want to be.
Gary Sherman is fascinating. I've been reading all these interviews with him. He does a lot of interviews. Because he did The Legend of Bo Diddley, which you mentioned last time.
I read through a list of all of his movies.
Yeah. Just a short documentary that he did. And then he did like a lot of TV work. And he didn't make a feature film until the movie Deathline in 1972. And that movie was taken away from him by the studio and reworked. Too much to his chagrin, and into a movie called Raw Meat. And he was like, well, forget it then. So he went back to working in television. He didn't make another feature film for almost 10 years, which is this movie, Dead and Buried. And he says in interviews that 90% of this movie he's happy with. Because again, the movie was taken away from him and reworked by the studio.
Studios.
Yeah, so he was so unhappy. He was just like, come on, I waited 10 years and you did it to me again? And so after this one, he did the movie Vice Squad, and he's very happy with Vice Squad. But Sherman's an interesting guy, and he loves to talk about his work. He's very specific about the kind of movies he makes. He's always trying to put messages into them, meaning into them. He came up in the 60s alongside... Jonathan Demme. He came up alongside Jonathan Demme. They were like filmmaking partners, essentially. And so both of their goals was like make meaningful movies. And he kept trying to make meaningful movies. And then the studios kept like being like, what's all this thinking garbage? Put more gore in it. And so he was like, ugh. But what's funny is now he's known as kind of a horror crime, really gritty filmmaker. And his last feature film was 2005's 39, a film by Carol McCain, which he only showed at a few horror film festivals, and then he pulled it, and he won't allow it to be shown again because he's too disturbed by his own movie. And he says that he doesn't want to show it again because he doesn't want to have to watch it again.
Well, he doesn't have to watch it again.
So I was just like, wow, that's... Apparently, it's a really upsetting film.
There's a lot of really upsetting films out there. What makes this one so much worse than the others?
I don't know, because I've never seen it. But he's done a lot of TV. One really interesting thing he did a TV movie called Mysterious 2 that's about the couple, essentially. They're really a couple, kind of a couple, that started the Heaven's Gate cult. That got really famous in the late 90s because when they all committed suicide so they could board a spaceship that was attached to the Hale-Bopp comet. But he made this movie about them kind of like in the earlier days of their cult, before they were well known at all, before they hit the news at all. And apparently it's not very good, but he was on
the one thing about the Heaven's Gate cult leader dude that I have to say is that at least he also believed in all of the nonsense he was spouting.
Oh yeah, no, they were that kind of cult. He totally believed in what he was doing.
He wasn't just like a psychopath or sociopath running a bunch of people into ruining their lives and killing themselves.
Yeah, I mean they did, but they believed in it. So so help them. So this movie,
maybe
Dead and Buried.
Maybe they're in space.
So this movie, Dead and Buried, started out, I guess, as more of a comedy, dark comedy, very, very dark comedy. But then the studio changed it a bit in post-production. But he's, like I said, he's 90% happy with this movie. And so I'm excited about enjoying 90% of it.
That's a solid A-.
That's a solid A-. Yeah, yeah. So
maybe you'll only enjoy 10% of Dead and Buried.
Maybe, yeah. Because maybe I don't like him as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yes. So
I mean, he made Poltergeist 3.
He did make Poltergeist 3. yeah, he made Poltergeist 3, which he doesn't like either. He says that Poltergeist 3 is terrible. He says it's a terrible movie that he liked two bits from, and the rest of it he thinks is garbage. They made him go back. And so I was trying to remember if the little girl from Poltergeist 3 had died before or after it was released, and I couldn't remember. Mm-hmm. And the reason I couldn't remember is because he filmed the movie, and then producers were like, we need you to go back and film a new ending and up the action and up the special effects and stuff. But in between that happening, that's when Heather O'Rourke died. And he was like, none of us want to go go back and film any of this movie at all. Like, where it'd be a terrible thing to have to do that. The lead died, and she was a beautiful little girl. And they were like, you got to do it. So they had to go back and refilm the ending using a little girl as a stand-in for the deceased Heather O'Rourke. It was just bad for everyone all around.
You know, I think at that point I would have just been like, I quit. Yeah. Have fun with this unfinished movie, studio.
So yeah, that's the sad tale of Gary Sherman directing Poltergeist 3. But Willow, I am ready to watch Dead and Buried.
I am ready to be dead and buried.
I think you made that joke at the beginning of the episode.
You interrupted me while I was making it.
So again, if you're just tuning in, this is part of the Guillermo del Toro Ecstasy of Influence, 1981's Dead and Buried. I am Phil.
I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro time. You sounded really unsure of that. So, we watched Dead and Buried.
Yeah. What an interesting movie.
I like this movie more and more the more I live with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a bit... It's an interesting movie.
It goes places, and it gets there in a weird way, and then there's a gigantic twist at the end, and then on rewatching the movie, knowing the twist, it only makes the movie better, because it's like, oh, wow, okay, I'm noticing all these things now that I hadn't noticed before. Some people might say the twist is obvious. I didn't see it coming because I wasn't looking for it. I was just enjoying the movie. But I thought it was a dynamite film.
It's fun.
A real crackerjack.
It's fun.
Real.
There is
hootin' holler.
A scene in it, or a series of scenes, I suppose. A chunk of it that makes no sense.
There's a bit of this movie that, in retrospect, makes very little sense, partly because of the way he was forced to re-edit the entire movie out of order. The final distributors of the film demanded he re-edit the movie, add in a bunch of stuff, and move scenes around that make part of it just not incomprehensible, but if you look at it and think about it for more than a second, you're like, wait, why is this happening now? It should be happening. They made some choices, and I think the movie works despite those choices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was mostly talking about the scene with the family.
We'll talk about the scene with the family because there are reasons that scene is so freaking weird. And it has to do with...
Funny. It's funny.
It has to do with the original tone of the film. It has to do with child labor laws come into play. And a quarter mile sized flag comes into play as to why that scene is so weird.
I think it's funny because it was supposed to be a horror comedy.
It's weird. You know, I read a lot of interviews with Richard Sherman. I listened to his commentary track, and he keeps mentioning that. He's like, this was supposed to be a dark comedy. This was supposed to be much more sardonic and ironic. But he could never quite... Well, they would ask him, like, so what do you mean? Like, what was the tone supposed to be like? He could never explain it. He was like, just trust me. It was different, and it all changed. It was different. And, like, no one seems to know, like, what the original... Because no original cut of this movie exists. The studio actually made him destroy his original cut so that it wouldn't exist anywhere. Because they didn't want any distributors to get confused as to which version was the actual version.
How stupid do they think their distributors are?
Stupid.
Just put them in a box and label one of them trash and one of them
version.
Not this version. This is the wrong one. Or just don't distribute the wrong one.
Yeah, it's studios are weird. Film distributors are weird. I'm sorry, I said Richard Sherman. It's not Richard Sherman. I keep wanting to call him Richard Sherman because he's one of the Sherman brothers who wrote songs for Disney. Gary Sherman is the director of this. It's not Richard Sherman. It's a totally different guy. My apologies, Gary.
Don't give Disney any more credit than they deserve.
I won't. So Gary Sherman, it had been almost a 10-year gap, we mentioned, between his previous movie and this. He'd had such a bad experience making movies before that he decided to stick to television. To his benefit, because he made a lot of great connections in television, there's a lot of crossover in this movie with John Carpenter's TV movie of the life of Elvis Presley that came out right before this, because John Carpenter, of course, John Carpenter, famous horror filmmaker and action filmmaker, was also doing TV at the time. And he made this Elvis movie, and Gary Sherman, doing TV, knew a lot of these people and sort of brought them over into this movie when he got the opportunity to make a major motion picture. The story of this movie was, this is weird, story of this movie was by Jeff Millar and Alex Stern, and nobody knows who these guys are. All anyone can say is these two guys, Jeff Millar and Alex Stern, came up with the story of Dead and Buried, the end. And then Ron Shusett got the story from them and wrote the screenplay. He put Dan O'Banion's name on it because he was like, no one will look at this unless it has your name on it. So O'Banion was like, I don't like this script, but here's some ideas. And Shusett was like, I'm not going to do any of that. But because Dan O'Bannon's name was on it, it got picked up after Alien got famous. And then, but no one knows who Jeff Millar and Alex Stern, they have no other credits. This is it. These are their only two credits. And they wrote the story for Dead and Buried, and they disappeared forever. That's all I got to say about that.
Maybe they're just two guys. It's two guys who were like, what if we wrote a story and just sent it to one guy? And then he wrote a screenplay, and then we got famous. And then they were just like, that's not how that works.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you shop a story idea around Hollywood. I wonder if they, like, came up with this idea, and they shopped it around for a long time, and finally were just like, this isn't worth it. Like, this is... Hollywood sucks. I mean, Shusett wrote this screenplay, and presumably with Dan O'Bannon, before Alien got picked up. I mean, they were sitting on a few stories, and so this had been around for a while. Like, because this is 81 when this movie hits, 80 when it's made, but Alien was a few years previous, and they were strapping Alien around for a long time before Alien got made. So Dead and Buried was just kind of this sort of screenplay that was floating in the ether. So this movie is originally going to be produced by Guinness, the beer makers. Guinness decided to get into the movie industry. They were like, hey, we've got the beer thing locked down. Hey, we've got the trivia book thing locked down. The Books of World Records. We've got those two things. Let's make movies. And so they bought a film studio. They hired Gary Sherman. And then in the middle of pre-production, they were like, we don't want to make movies anymore. So they sold the studio. That's when the first changes got made. The new money people came in and were like, you can't make this a comedy. This can't be a comedy. And he was like, but it was already going to be like a dark comedy. And they're like, you got to make it a straightforward horror movie. You got to make it straightforward horror. And so that was when the first changes. Then they got bought out during the first editing process. And that's when the new people came in and were like, this movie isn't gory enough. You've got to go back and film gore scenes. And so he had to go back and make all the ultra violent stuff that happens in the movie was added later, and he did not want to add it. So there was a lot involved in this movie that ended up not making much of an impression after it came out. How does that make you feel about the Hollywood film industry?
I already hated the Hollywood film industry, so, you know.
It didn't build up your confidence in them? I mean, no. I guess maybe it's definitely changed in 30-some, 40 years. You're not going to... This type of movie would never even hit the theaters. I mean, hardly any movie.
Support independent producers.
I guess. I don't know.
Support someone.
It's such a bizarre movie. This is a really weird... Okay, so let's talk about... What is this movie about? This is a weird little flick.
This movie is about a guy whose marriage is falling apart.
I mean, is it falling apart? They seem pretty happy together. Sheriff Dan.
Throughout the movie, it's slowly falling apart. It starts out with them being happy together, and then they sort of start separating and blah, 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 blah.
Well, he starts getting paranoid and suspecting her of something. I like that you, that you zeroed in on the failing marriage. Like, that's part of the character development, but you're like, this is a movie about a failing marriage.
It is.
Even it starts with a man being burned alive on the beach.
Well, yeah, but the movie ends with the failing marriage. Like the movie ends with the marriage failing. Like there's a lot of extra stuff happening, but it really is about this guy whose marriage sucks.
It's, I mean, I can, that is a read that I totally respect on this movie. And saying this movie ends with the marriage failing is soft selling it a little bit, I would say. But that, I mean, that's kind of like saying that, like, Star Wars ends with a disappointed father. And you're like, I mean, I guess.
Star Wars doesn't end with a disappointed father. It ends with a proud father.
What's, which father are you talking about?
I'm talking about Darth Vader. Are we talking about different fathers?
I mean, he is disappointed, though, because Obi-Wan's ghost disappears, and he kicks the robes with his toe, and he looks sad about it. He's like, aw. And you can say that Star Wars is a movie about a boy whose uncle dies. That's the same as saying this is a movie about a family.
I mean, it Star kind Wars of is.
Star Wars is a movie about a farm boy whose uncle dies. And he deal, has he about a farm boy dealing with the death of his uncle and aunt.
It is.
It is. It is. You could say that and be honest about it, but I wouldn't.
And you could write it. You could write a pretty compelling paper about his behavior and how that ties in with the grief.
That's true. You could also write a paper about how Mark Hamill, about how Luke Skywalker is grieving the death of his uncle and aunt, and then later the death of Obi-Wan Kenobi, and never says anything to Princess Leia about her entire planet being blown up in front of her. He's like, oh man, I really miss Ben. She's like, yeah, it must be hard losing that old guy you met 2 days ago. That's a point that's been made by people better than I am. But yeah, so Sheriff Dan Gillis is the sheriff of this small town. That it's a small New England town, but it is actually not named Potter's Bluff.
Potter's Bluff.
Potter's Bluff.
No wizard boys here.
There's no wizard boys. It's in New England. I believe it's supposed to be like, it's like in Rhode Island, someplace like that. It's on the East Coast. However, the movie was filmed almost entirely in Mendocino, California. And if you don't know Mendocino, it is in, like, it's on the West Coast, coastal town. It's north in California. And it looks like a New England fishing village. Like, it looks.
It does.
It looks like a new, like, there, what Sherman did is he was like, so I knew Mendocino and it looked perfect. All I did was I filmed it using my own made up geography of the town. So if you knew Mendocino, you'd recognize the locations, but you'd be like, wait, how is he filming? Like, he would have characters go from one street to a street that doesn't actually connect to, just to sort of create his own version of Mendocino to be Potter's Bluff. But you can go visit Mendocino and find a lot of these locations. They're still there. The buildings are all there. And it's, yeah, it looks
I
like
I have
it,
to
it,
imagine there's no, like, placard that says Dead and Buried was filmed here because no one would know what they were talking about.
There's a special feature on the Blu-ray of visiting the locations, and I didn't see any plaques. place where a young hitchhiker gets her head smashed in by rock probably isn't a huge tourist attraction.
It would be for our particular crowd.
It would be for this crowd, definitely. Mendocino, he chose it also because Mendocino gets very foggy and he wanted a lot of fog. Mm. So most of the fog you see in this movie is real. Like, they were like, just nice. Oh, it's gonna be foggy, and it turned foggy. One of the first
they
stories
they were constrained by filming everything chronologically.
No. They certainly weren't. They also weren't constrained by using the real sky. One of the first uses of the quarter-mile-long giant flag they had to build was they would go out sometimes and the day would be too sunny, so they constructed a giant, giant flag to block the sky so they could have
nice.
Cloudy days when they needed it. So a lot of times these outside scenes, you have the sun being blocked by this Mr. Burns-esque shield blocking the sun from all human contact. It's amazing. We have the sheriff. It is Potter's Bluff. And what's the first thing that happens in this movie, though? It's fascinating.
A guy is taking photographs, and he's talking. Then there's a woman. She comes up to him, and they start flirting.
Yeah.
And there's a model shoot, and then surprise boobs.
Yeah, they were surprising.
Yeah. And then he gets burned alive.
Right. So he's taking pictures of this young woman played by the late Lisa Blount. She was an actress. She did a lot of, like, mostly television work in the 80s, but she went on to become an Oscar-winning producer. She won the Academy Award in 2001, I believe, for producing her husband's short film, The Accountant. So she won the Academy Award for that. And then she died in 2010 of idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, which is a blood clotting autoimmune deficiency disease that causes bleeding and bruising. And she was just found dead by her mother one morning. Died young.
Well, that 50, sucks.
Like 53 years old. Yeah. She hadn't done a lot in her later years because of her disease, but yeah, she was very respected in the industry. And she appeared in just a lot of like movies and TV shows. But yeah, so she plays this woman and he's taking pictures of her. She takes off her top and he's like humming a humming a humming a humming a. And then she starts coming on to him. And when he gets close to her, he is attacked by a group of people of all different ages. And like, so it's not like a group of like hippies. It's not a group of like serial killers. It just looks like a group of ordinary people. They tie him up in a
photography club.
Yeah. They tie him up. Yeah, they have cameras. They have lights. They tie him up in a horrific manner in a net that looks terrifying, and set him. They burn him alive. They burn him alive right there on the beach. And it's horrifying. Though. No. So what happens?
They frame it as a car accident. Mm-hmm. And the sheriff is like, there's a car accident.
Yeah.
We need the coroner here because, you know, dead guy. And so the coroner arrives. And they go over to the dead guy, and he's like, oh, psych, I'm not dead.
Mm-hmm. But he is burned
pretty
badly. Yeah, the van he's in is upside down, and he is basically a charred skeleton, and they're going to take the body out, and then it screams, and it's pretty horrifying. And that's our first sighting of a Stan Winston puppet man.
Puppet man?
What?
Puppet man?
Puppet man, the skeleton corpse in the van is not a real person. Fair. It is a Stan.
Really, that was really good done. Then really
it was
good
a
done.
Stan
really
Winston
well
puppet.
Done.
The theory, but from a lot of people, is that much of the budget in this movie went to paying Stan Winston, who was really ramping up his effects work at this time. The effects work in this movie is at times subtle to the point of I was like, oh, I had no idea. So this was, yeah, this was, that was not a man in makeup. That was a Stan Winston puppet that screamed. So yeah, he's
alive.
That's
really impressive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you haven't heard.
I didn't know it was a puppet.
You've heard nothing yet as far as what's impressive in this movie. This movie, Gary Sherman is like, he was going for broke with this movie. There is camera work in this film that is among some of the most impressive camera work I have ever seen done in a motion picture. And I didn't even notice it until it was pointed out. And I was like, holy crap, that was amazing. Because it was just, he just did it as a style. Sherman wanted this movie to be completely unsettling the whole time, but you weren't sure why it was unsettling. And one of the things he would do is he would break the rules of cinema with his editing, with his camera movements, in order to keep you kind of off kilter. Like, something's wrong here, and I don't know what it is. So he was doing stuff that kind of broke the rules of a Hollywood movie, but in, like, really gentle ways. It's just to kind of keep you being like, I don't know why this is so quirky, but it is. But so, yeah, so the man survives. And,
unfortunately.
Yeah, he's in a bad way. He is a fruity, yummy mummy at this point. That's how I describe all people who are severely burned. My apologies. Yeah, so let's talk about the relationship between the sheriff and the local coroner.
And mortician and dead guy person.
Yes. Dobbs. William G. Dobbs, the mortician, played by Jack Albertson.
And only doctor in town, it seems like.
No, there's the doctor, who's played by
the guy from
Kentucky Fried Movie.
Oh, right, yeah. I remember.
Yeah.
I thought he was just like a scientist dude.
No, he's the town doctor. They call him doctor. The poisonous fish will kill you faster than a bullet.
Will kill you faster than a bullet.
He's from that scene, ladies and gentlemen. He does not play the adventurer with the French accent in Kentucky Fried Movie. He plays the interviewer, Paul Burmaster, in Kentucky Fried Movie. I spent this whole film being like, who is that guy? And then I was like, it's Paul Burmaster. I'm Paul Burmaster.
And I was like, what are you talking about?
And this is high adventure. So in any case, Dobbs is kind of an odd duck.
Mm-hmm. Kind of reminds me of, there's an episode of Criminal Minds.
Of course there is. Of course there is.
And he reminds me of the coroner from that episode.
Yeah, and what I like about this is it's Jack Albertson, who is a fairly likable actor. He's, you know, he always plays like kind of gruff grandpa types. This is he's coming off of Chico and the Man at this point. He was in the process of dying of cancer while filming this movie.
Die like right after this movie?
He died like a couple of days after finishing his ADR for this film. And he gave 110%. Everyone loved working with him. But James Ferrantino, who played Sheriff Dan Gillis, one of the stories Gary Sherman tells is that James Ferrantino was filming a scene with Jack Albertson, and Jack Albertson fell asleep in the middle of the scene. He just dozed off. And James Ferrantino got very upset, and what they thought was he stormed off the set. They were like, oh my God, like, James Ferrantino was really pissed off at Jack Albertson for falling asleep in the middle of their scene. And so he goes to James Ferrantino's his van, his, what do you call it, his trailer. And he's like, hey, you know, like, I hope you're not too upset about Jack falling asleep. And Ferrantino was all, that's how my father died. He died in front of me in the middle of a conversation. He just closed his eyes and passed away. And it like sent James Ferrantino into like these massive flashbacks of being in his father's presence. And his father died because Jack Albertson was such a fatherly presence on the set, and they had developed a really close friendship, and it just wrecked Ferrantino. That's what was happening also on the set at the time, was everyone kind of knowing that Jack Albertson might not make it to the end of this film.
Jesus Christ.
There's your sad, dead, and buried story. Oh, also, Jack Albertson
quite
died
literally
2 days after finishing this movie. Yeah. He had like a few films that came out. He had a TV movie that came out that was filmed in like 1978 that didn't come out until like 1982. Like after this, like, he still had stuff coming out. He had a Fox and the Hound that came out after this. But this was, I think, his last major motion picture that he worked on. I mean, I hope so. Unless he made something in like 2 days after they finished filming. But no, that was Jack Albertson. So yeah, he plays Dobbs as kind of the crotchety, like, coroner, but who's also an artist who knows how to put a body back together after it's been killed. And he considers it his work of art. And he loves all of the bodies. And he's kind of weird that way. But you're like, all right. And they kind of set up that he's going to be Sheriff Dan's partner in figuring out what's going on in the town. Because what happens is people start dying. Tourists start dying. And or disappearing, and things start getting a little weird, because they figure out that the guy, the burn victim, was put back, that the whole accident scene was a setup, was kind of what the conclusion he starts coming to. And so he starts asking for assistance in solving these crimes. It is a little hard to remember the order things happen in, because there's a lot of random violent scenes that just sort of happen, and then you just sort of assume that that's just another victim. But it's all...
There's the guy who's killed on the docks. He's really drunk, and I was really annoyed at him the entire time he was on screen.
Yes. He gets murdered. That's one of the shots that was added later. You originally weren't supposed to see him get killed, but the studio insisted on a violent death. Because Sherman originally filmed this movie, so there was no red on screen ever. Even all the brake lights were replaced with purple brake lights, because he didn't want any red to be seen until the very end when you finally see blood. But then the studio was like, you got to go ahead and add some murder scenes. So there's all this blood in the middle of the movie, and they wrecked his little like theme. I don't think it matters. There's some really good special effects in here. But the drunk guy gets murdered. Should we just talk about the haunted house scene?
Yes, I want to talk about the haunted house scene.
So there's
the best scene in the movie.
There's a husband and a wife and their little boy, and they're just driving through town looking for directions. And this is also the moment where you see the photographer from the very beginning shows back up as just a person in the town. You're like, wait a minute, that's the guy, Freddy. That's the guy from the beginning. But now he's like a gas station attendant. And you're like, okay. But tell us what happens with this amazing scene.
So they are in, they go to a gas station because they're lost. And they get directions and stuff, and they're driving down the street when a person is in the front of the car and the guy swerves off into a tree.
Mm.
It's a very normal crash. Like, nothing really seemed to happen. Yeah. And they're like, oh, God, we got to... Our
the
son
little
has
boy
been
bumps his
horribly,
head.
Has been horribly maimed. We've got to get help. There's a house right there. And while the father is doting on his son, the mother sees a light in the house. And she's like, there's a light in the house. You should go ask them for help. And he's like, there's no light in the house. And they get into this weird argument about whether or not there was light in the house.
It's a long argument.
And they're like, it is. It's a long argument. And then they're like, whatever. Let's just go up to the house and see if they have some ice.
Yeah.
Instead of getting in their functioning car and
driving.
It's
a pitch black house, by the way. Like, there's no lights on in this house.
And then they get up and they go to the house and they knock on the door and it's open.
Mm-hmm.
And then pandemonium.
We call this house the haunted house. Why do we call it the haunted house?
Because it's a haunted house. It is a it haunted is, ass house.
It is. This is not an inviting house.
No.
It's clearly abandoned. It is covered in cobwebs and dust. Would it surprise you if I told you this was not a set? This was a house they found that they didn't do anything to.
Damn.
This was they found this house and were like, this is it. This is the abandoned house. They just were like, we can film here and save a lot of trouble. It's just an abandoned house. I think it may have been somewhere in California that they located it. They thought they were going to save themselves a lot of trouble by filming in this actual haunted house. Because, okay, so what happens to the couple? This scene is like an hour long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They go through the house and they're like, maybe they're in the basement.
Again, it's clearly a haunted house.
They're like, let's check the refrigerator. It's completely empty.
Mm-hmm. There's no electricity in this house.
No, the piano is covered in dust and cobwebs. The mm-hmm. boy's like, can we please just go?
Yeah, we have a functioning car.
They're like, yeah, they're like, no, we got to find the people in this house. Let's keep going deeper into the house. This is fine.
Yelling
there's shadows
hello.
All around them.
Mm-hmm.
So stupid.
We
and
keep seeing,
and we were just
we
like,
keep seeing,
what are you
doing? We keep seeing people in the windows. There's like obviously people creeping around outside. And they're like, well, maybe they're in the basement. So they go to the basement. Or maybe like there's a circuit breaker blown. And so the dad goes
Dad goes to the basement and he has a box of matches.
Right.
And he's lighting the matches. And they're the shortest matches ever, apparently. Mm. And he's like, I didn't see anyone in the basement with my matchbox that illuminates half an inch in front of me.
Right. Yeah, they're in there for a while looking for ice, and they can't find any ice. Again, they were heading to a gas station, which probably has ice.
Mm-hmm.
So they're attacked by this mob of filmmakers. The mob has you always know it's the mob. They have a giant like light tree that they haul around with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being attacked by the townspeople. I mean, it's clearly the townspeople. Mm-hmm. Or a group of them. They get chased out of the house into their car, which works, remember.
They start driving.
Mm-hmm. And what happens?
They hit someone.
No, a woman pops up in the back seat.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And attacks them.
And then they get her out, though.
Yeah, they get her out.
And they keep driving.
Mm-hmm.
And then the scene ends.
That's it, yeah.
And you assume they're fine.
Yeah, They make it out. It's a traumatic experience for all of them. Now, it was also a traumatic experience for the filmmakers because they had this keen house. They were like, oh, this is going to be easy. But child labor laws, remember I was going to mention child labor laws. Child labor laws said, oh, you can't film at night with a child. You can't film with a child at night. The child's got to go to bed. Well, they're like, well, we have this kid. The kid's the integral part of the storyline. We've cast the kid. We've hired the kid. The scene takes place at night. That's what makes it scary. So they had to take this quarter mile long sheet, this flag, and drape it over the entire house so they could film as if it were night, and then they would light it. Just there's enough light coming through the windows, so look, it was night, but you couldn't breathe under the tent because it was too airtight, so they had to have fans blowing air the whole time, which meant that you couldn't hear anything. So that meant that all the dialogue in the scene had to be re-recorded because it was just the sound of these nightmare fans blowing. So if you look at the scene, hardly any of their lips match what they're saying because it's mostly just a lot of yelling.
That's Okay, so that wasn't just a weird glitch on my end.
No. There's a lot of ADR in this movie, and some of it is nightmarishly bad. But yeah, especially in this scene.
I think that made the scene more fun.
The scene's very fun and very stupid. But then they run outside with the boy, and they still have to be doing this during the day. So they have another giant tent that has to cover the daylight, but not to make it look like a cloudy day at this point, to make it look like night. So they're basically filming inside a bug tent and
circus tent.
And any time that it cuts away and you can't see the little boy, it's at night. They're like, we'll film the coverage at night. We'll get everyone else happening at night. It was a wreck. It was a bad choice on their part. They should have just built a house in a soundstage and just filmed it that
way.
It would have been a lot easier.
They could have just had the boy get taken by one of the people right away.
Or just written around the boy. Just been like, maybe there's no boy. Maybe we get in a car accident and my husband hits his head and they need help
from
the house.
And we need to get ice.
Yeah. You don't only need ice for a boy. You can get ice for anyone, Gary Sherman. But it's still a great
scene. But they hired the boy.
Hired the
boy. And they still had to pay the boy. So the boy was going to do the work the boy was meant to do.
Should have used a porcelain boy. That would have been a lot better. They should have hired the boy. And
there we go.
And there could have been like this whole, people have been like, wait a minute, that's not a real boy. Like viewers would be like, it's clearly a doll.
She's a puppet.
But that could have been there's another story going on outside of town with this weird couple and their porcelain boy. His head breaks. His head shatters in the accident. And they're like, we have to get him some ice. So.
And then we see there's a man who's never, ever acknowledged in the back of the car next to the boy. He doesn't get out or anything. It's Brahms.
Brahms.
He's just in the back of the car. That's right. And no one ever acknowledges him.
That's right. So also the sheriff, Gillis, hits someone in the middle of the street around this time. He hits a man with his car. And when he gets out of the car, the man is in the middle of the road and his arm is stuck to the front of the car. And Gillis is like, well, that's weird because the arm is still moving. And then the man gets up and grabs his arm and runs away. Perfect scene.
That was such a good scene.
Let's talk about the failing a marriage a little bit, because I really want to talk about Melody Anderson as his wife, Janet, who does a great job. She's phenomenal in this movie. Even her non-horror scenes, the scenes with the children, she's a school teacher. The scenes with her class are a delight to watch. She's very fun. But let's talk about her. So what's going on with their marriage? Why is he so weird about his wife?
So first, there's Freddie the photographer.
Yeah.
And he's told by the hotel person that his wife showed up to spend time with Freddie the photographer at the hotel.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, that's weird.
Right.
So he goes home and is like, I heard you were at a hotel with a guy. And she was like, what, the photographer? I was picking up some stuff for the school. And he was like, oh, okay, I guess that makes sense. And then they have a cute moment. And everything's happy.
Yeah.
And then...
he runs into the principal.
Right, yeah. And he's like, so, about that photographer stuff. The principal's like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Right.
So he's like, well, that's weird.
Yeah. So he asks his wife about it, and she's like, oh, I just didn't tell the principal about it. It was going to be a surprise. Like,
there goes the surprise, I guess.
Yeah. She plays really well. Like,
yeah.
She's so nonchalant. Like, she's hiding something, but the actress doesn't signal that. She's like, oh, well, there goes to the surprise. We got the photography equipment for the prince. Like, she's
really
good.
She has the single best wardrobe in this movie.
What makes it the best?
Her outfits are amazing.
It's early 80s school teacher chic, and she looks good. Melody Anderson, by the way, Gary Sherman thought it was quite a coup getting her. Thought it was a huge deal getting her in this movie, because she had just filmed the female lead in the movie Flash Gordon. And everyone knew that Flash Gordon was going to be the hit movie of the year. That they had scored the up-and-coming actress without having to pay her up-and-coming actress prices. And that Flash Gordon was going to come out. It was going to be a major hit. And that was just going to propel this movie into the stratosphere, because they had the Flash Gordon actress. Flash Gordon comes out. It is not a major hit. It does okay. It almost doubles its budget. But it's a major disappointment. And she doesn't become the lead actress, which is a shame because, as we said, Melody Anderson does a really good job in this movie. And she did a few more films. And then in the mid 90s, she retired and became a licensed therapist. She is still working today in the substance abuse and mental health related areas. She is a well-respected therapist. She appears at conventions every once in a while, like sci-fi cons and stuff like that, like for her Flash Gordon appearance. Perfectly happy not being an actor anymore. And I'm like, totes respect. Melody Anderson, I don't think you get enough attention for your performance in Dead and Buried. It's she goes above and beyond. Like, she plays this role so well. Because you see this whole scene, everything that weird that happens around her, she has an answer for. Her husband at one point finds books of witchcraft hidden in her sock drawer, and she's like, oh, that's for my class. I'm teaching them about the resurrection.
Talking about religion, and I wanted to teach them about some of the other more obscure religions.
And even though,
that makes sense.
And then even though he's kind of like, okay, later on, you see her teaching this to the class. Like, you actually see, they're maybe a little young for the subject.
I disagree. I think that this would be a hit with kids that age. I think that if my teachers had done that, it would have been really successful.
Yeah, she's doing a whole class on the resurrection of the dead for children. And this is also kids, where you see
kids are scared of zombies, and if they get to hear about zombies, they're going to be excited.
Yeah, they are excited. They're having a good time. But she's really fun to watch in this scene. And one of the little boys in her class is the little boy from the haunted house. Who you're like, wait a minute, they don't live in town. So you know that something happened to these people. And now the little boy is a town member. I should point out also, there is a scene between Sheriff Gillis and his wife where she comes home one evening. She pulls up in her car. She walks up to the house. She comes inside. She and her
she
husband
had all those packages.
Mm-hmm. I think this might be when she asks her husband to get some film developed. And they have a conversation in the living room, and then she leaves, and he's kind of left there like, the entire scene is one take, and not only is it one take, this is kind of a little hard to describe, but the camera starts with her, the car pulls up, she gets out of the car, walks towards the viewer, and the camera backs up following her, okay? Keeps backing up, and all of a sudden, a door opens. It's the front door of the house. Somehow, the camera got behind the front door of the house, into the house, for her to open it up. What they did was, they actually had to take the entire front door, attach it to the front of the camera, follow her back with the whole front door attached to the camera. In one smooth moment, it hits the door frame. They put pins in the hinges, and then open the door for her, or let her open the door. I can't remember how it works. She opens the door, but the door was connected to the camera. And then in one seamless movement, they detach it from the camera and attach it to the door frame so that she can then open the door. And in one movement, just continue into the house, into the one take scene between her and her husband. It's a great scene. Was originally supposed to then follow her back out. He's supposed to look out the window and see her get into the car, and then the camera is supposed to go through the window and follow her to the car as it drives away. But then the distributors were like, scene's too long, gotta cut that ending. And he was like, ah, it was my masterpiece one take scene. That footage no longer exists, so we can never see how it ended. But when I heard that, I was so angry that they not only made him cut that scene, but also destroyed the footage, because I want to see the whole take. But again, if you know what you're looking for, it is mind-bogglingly smooth and amazing. And you're just like, yeah, Gary Sherman was like, yeah, I'm making a great film. I want to make an amazingly made film using film techniques that no one's ever done.
I'm going to swear. You're going to have to bleep it, okay? Fuck the distributors. Screw them. Yep. All of them can go to hell.
I can't believe
they should be dead and buried.
They should be dead and buried. You're right. They should all die for making the man cut his movie down.
They should.
We didn't mention that. So Freddie, the photographer, who's burned to a crisp, is a fruity, yummy mummy laying in the hospital. And he's bound completely. You only can see his mouth and one eye, the eye that's remaining. What happens to poor Freddie in the hospital?
He is stabbed in the eye with a needle.
Yes. By whom?
by, what did he call her?
What do you mean? Like her name?
Because they made, I don't think we ever learned her real name. It's Lisa.
They call her Lisa. Names.
Lisa, okay.
Her name is Lisa, yeah.
By Lisa, the nurse. The person
who was the woman who was the woman on the beach.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, wow, she's just getting away with dressing up like a nurse and wandering through this hospital doing whatever. We find out later on, of course, why she probably was able to get away with it. Mm-hmm. But so what exactly does she do? And is it done with a discreet cutaway so you can't really see the action?
No. I mean, I did it myself. I cut away myself. I was like, oh, she stabs him in the eye with a needle.
A long needle.
A very long needle.
And now what's
he yells.
He yells a lot and then he dies.
Yeah.
We don't know how it kills him. I guess getting a long needle in the eye maybe would kill you.
I mean, if you stab it in the brain, maybe there was like something in the syringe, because it was a syringe. So maybe she like there was like poison or something in there.
Yes.
Although I have to imagine if you inject air into your brain, that's not good.
So Christopher Allport, who plays Freddy and is later known as, or he play, I can't remember which name he starts out with.
He starts out with Freddy.
Okay. Christopher Allport.
That's why the scene is so weird, because she knows his name.
Yeah. Two amazing things about this scene. Can't see the actor very well. You can only see his eye and his teeth. So all the performance is done by this guy. He's completely bound up. All you can see are his teeth and his eye. So you're only getting his panicked reaction. No, you can see in his expression that he knows this is not going to end well when this woman stabs him in the eye. Very limited movement. Amazing performance. Mm-hmm. Here's the mind-blowing part that I was like, what? That's a puppet.
What?
Christopher Allport was never bound in bandages. The entire time you see him, that's a Stan Winston puppet. The whole thing is a Stan Winston puppet. They never put the man in bandages. They had a cast of his head. They created a puppet. They created a fake eye, a mouth. And Stan Winston was like, I have to be able to get a performance out of this eye that looks like an actual panicking person. That's a puppet. The whole thing is a made up man. Christopher Allport never set foot on the hospital set. That was entirely a fake man. That blew my mind. That is an amazing piece of work.
That is awesome.
And because they were they were like, we want to be able to really stab the eye. And the only way we're going to do it is if we can just stab the eye. Got to be a puppet.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That, when I found out that wasn't a guy in bandages, I could not, because it moves so realistically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stan Winston, my friends. Stan Winston. Amazing special effects guy. A hitchhiker gets killed.
My favorite character. This scene is important, not because of anything that happens in the movie, but it's because it leveled up our relationship.
How did it level up our relationship?
You made the first joke to me about being a lesbian, and that was, I didn't get it because you'd never made a joke to me about being a lesbian before, but that was pretty amazing. I have to say that was, I felt it was very heartwarming.
Aw, what did I say?
You said, so we were watching the hitchhiker get picked up and you said you'd pick her up, and I was like, what? Why? And you're like, because she has the whole rugged lesbian look going on, and I was like, haha, lesbian joke.
She does have the whole rugged lesbian. Actress named Lisa Marie.
She's also very, very pretty.
She is very cute. Lisa Marie wasn't in a whole lot of things. This is not Lisa Marie Presley, who married Elvis Presley, or was there Elvis Presley's daughter. This is not the Lisa Marie who would go on to be a partner with Tim Burton and would appear in all the Tim Burton films, although she has a similar look. Just actress named Lisa Marie. She wasn't in a lot of things. But she has a pointy nose. A very mm-hmm. pointy nose. She's very cute. She has a pointy nose. And she was cast because she has a pointy nose.
Yeah.
That's why they said they cast her. They needed someone whose face would be instantly recognizable when you see her later on. And they're like, mm-hmm. that woman is cute and has a nose that no one else has. It is turned up and very pointy, but also very cute. And it is true. When you see her later on, you're like, oh, that's the hitchhiker. How does she die?
She has her face smashed in with a rock.
It's horrific. You don't see her face get smashed in, but you see her later.
Yeah.
Stan Winston special effects.
What is this when we compared it to Eyes Without a Face?
Yes. How come?
Because there's a surgery face scene.
Mm-hmm.
Awful.
Yeah. You see her get all the skin removed from her face. And then you see her whole face get rebuilt by the coroner.
Do they do that thing that they did in Eyes Without a Face where they had the pictures and they sort of phased in pictures each, mm-hmm. like, for each layer?
Yeah. And this is another
Because they did amazing... that in Eyes Without a Face as well.
You see her on the slab afterwards, and you see her get an eyeball put in because mm-hmm. the
that
coroner
was really
has...
cool.
You see her eyelids get pulled back, and you see an eye get put in, and then the eyelid goes back, and then you see the body sit up, and it's really Lisa Marie. And the way they did that was entirely a puppet in the beginning, a Stan mm-hmm. Winston puppet of Lisa Marie. They had to come up with a new technique to do skin so that the eyelid looked real. Camera then pans up. You see Dobbs working on her, cans back down. He walks off. Her body has been replaced in that cutaway, in that like pan up. They've wheeled off the puppet, wheeled on the real Lisa Marie, who looks exactly the same. She sits up and it's really her. And just such a well done piece of special effects work just to get that one shot. Just amazing.
The special effects in this movie are mwah.
Very good. With the exception of the doctor who figures out that the dead arm from the guy who the sheriff hit with his car, the tissue that the sheriff collects and gives to the doctor to analyze, he's like, this guy was dead for months. You couldn't have hit mm-hmm. him with your car.
Or, well, because the sheriff never says he hit him with the car.
Right, right.
It's from a hit and run. Which, you know, I guess sheriff stuff.
There's a murder scene of the doctor, which was mm-hmm. not only added later, was not done by Stan Winston, because the puppet of the doctor mm-hmm. looks horrendous. It does not look like a real guy. It looks like a dummy that's been rigged to explode. And the people who did that special effects, they didn't have a lot of time, didn't have a lot of money, wasn't Stan Winston. And they were told it had to all be done in one smooth shot, so they couldn't do the amount of work they wanted to do or something. And they realized that if they knew how it was going to be filmed, they would have made a better looking dummy. They were just like, mm-hmm. we thought it was going to be a distance shot, and they ended up doing a close up. So it looked terrible. But yeah, they inject acid into his nose or something. Nobody wanted this scene to happen. It doesn't actually make any sense that the doctor would get killed like this. There's no reason for it to happen because of the stuff we
learned.
Also,
that's not how acid works.
Also, that's not how acid works. It doesn't explode out of your face if you inject it up someone's nose. You also discover, and let's sort of barrel on to the end through this plot, because you discover that Dobbs, the coroner, was the chief pathologist in Providence, but he was dismissed for doing experiments in the morgue. We find out that Jack and Albertson, that Dobbs, has developed a way to reanimate the dead, and we mm-hmm. don't know how he's reanimated the dead. We just know that he's somehow done it. Whether it's science, whether it's magic, they never really clear that up. How does the sheriff, though, discover that this is the case? What is his big final revelation? What happens in this?
Well, the first thing he does is he digs up the grave of Freddy.
Right.
I think this is where we discover that it's magic, though, because she's talking about the witchcraft thing where you have to take the hearts out of the people and
right,
stuff.
Right, right. Yeah. She tells her class that you have to keep the heart separate from the reanimated corpse, and the only way to kill the corpse is to destroy the heart.
Yeah. So we see the heart is in the casket instead of Freddy.
Yeah.
Whatever. But the way that this is revealed is the video that his wife wanted edited, he watches it, and it is a video of her murdering someone.
Yeah.
And a bunch of townspeople.
Yeah.
And so he goes after Dobbs.
And Dobbs has all these films playing in his office.
Mm-hmm.
And one is of a woman in bed with a man. And while mm-hmm. they're having sex, she pulls out a knife and stabs the man to death. And then when the camera, mm-hmm. It's obviously being filmed by someone else. The camera moves around mm-hmm. and you see that the woman stabbing the man to death is his wife. Mm-hmm. And then she shows up and she mm-hmm. has no idea what's going on.
Yep.
And it is a
emotionally harrowing scene.
Yes. It is a... probably the scariest scene in the movie because of her reaction. Because they've said that Dobbs has said, like, when I reanimate the dead, I can give them whatever memories I want. Like, they'll only remember what I tell them to remember. I can, like, make up whole new personalities for them. These are my people. So she just shows up and she's like, hey, honey, I got some, like, dinner's ready. And how does Sheriff Gillis react?
He shoots her.
Multiple
Which
times.
Which is fair.
I guess. And she reacts in such a weird way. Like, she's momentarily distracted by each bullet, and then she just keeps talking about dinner. Like, she doesn't notice she's being shot, and it doesn't affect her. Mm-hmm. Until one gunshot happens, and you see her flinch and kind of look really weird, and then she goes right back into the conversation. And that happened because a squib blew right next to Melody Anderson's ear and deafened her for a couple of days. But she played it off in the scene and just kept going. She was like, oh, so you see Janet react, like, it's almost like for 1 second she's aware of what's going on. And then mm-hmm. she just continues to talk. And no, that's actually Melody Anderson having this loud explosion by her head and being like, what the? Anyway, I'm
the hell is that?
Yeah. And he keeps shooting her until she finally realizes that something's off. And she starts telling her husband to bury her. Mm-hmm. And it's tragic. And she goes... Because he's at the gravesite. He gets attacked by all the townspeople at
Does
the gravesite.
Does he get attacked?
Or something. Like, it's very confusing.
No,
as to
I thought what was happening was he goes to the gravesite. She's in the grave. Still alive. Or undead. And the townspeople are all coming to give their respects to her.
Yeah. Because she's like, bury me, bury me. And she lays down in the grave. And he buries her alive. Mm-hmm. Or dead. Because she's a reanimated corpse. And the town's all reanimated corpses. He has shot Dobbs at this point, at point-blank range mm-hmm. in the stomach. And while he's burying his wife alive, Dobbs is performing he's doing the, like, coroner stuff on himself. Like, he's draining mm-hmm. himself of the blood. And he's basically doing the treatment that he does to the other corpses on his own body. Oh, because the only way you can reanimate a corpse is if it has died. It has to die horrifically. It has to mm-hmm. know it's dying. The person has to die. It has to be, like, horrifically killed so that they are fully aware mm-hmm. that they are being murdered. Which is why all the deaths in the movie are horrific, because the person has to be a traumatic death. Jack Albertson, the sheriff runs back to Jack Albertson's office. Jack Albertson is fully revived. He's no longer dying of gunshot wounds. He has died and come back. And we see the rest of the scene of his wife killing the man during sex. And who is the man she killed?
Him.
It's the sheriff.
Husband.
He's been dead this entire time. He looks at his hands. They are falling apart because the bodies have to be, like, Jack Albertson has to keep fixing the bodies up because they're dead bodies. So his hands are like split and the bones are showing through his fingers. And Jack Albertson says something like, can I fix you up there?
I can fix those for you.
Yeah, I can fix those for you. And then it just ends because that's all you need to see. The sheriff's been dead the entire, everyone in town has been dead this entire time. It's just been Dobbs playing with his puppets the whole time. And you get the sense that, and what freaks me out is this isn't the first time that the sheriff has figured this out. This is just a game they play. Their people will die. The sheriff will get suspicious. He has just enough memory to solve the murder again. And then he goes through all this painful realization. And then Jack Albertson.
I have to imagine his wife then has also been revived several times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I believe that. And they just sort of replenish the town every once in a while. Like, they have to get some new victims. So some drifters will come through. Some tourists will come through town. They'll kill them, have some new townsfolk. And that's it. This is just, and now that Dobbs has resurrected himself, there's just no end to it. Like, this will just keep going in this town forever. And that's the story of Dead and Buried. I still think it's a wickedly funny little film at times.
It is.
It's.
I also still think this is the story of a man whose marriage is falling apart.
And whose hands are falling apart at the end. Yeah. I liked this movie a lot. A lot, a lot. Mm-hmm. And I like it more the more I think about it, because it shouldn't be as good as it is. It should just be a little... Oh, and also Robert Englund, Freddy Krueger, is in it, playing the character of Harry
the
Tow Truck Driver.
I was right. He is in it. Okay.
Yeah. The role was written for
him. Who
is
he playing?
Harry the Tow Truck Driver.
Okay.
He shows up he's throughout the movie. He has a lot of lines. He's just one of the townsfolk. This is before Nightmare on Elm Street, but post Robert Englund being in, like, Eaten Alive. He had been in a lot of, like, small horror films, kind of getting a name for himself as a character actor. Everyone loves working with Robert Englund, so everyone wanted to constantly work with Robert Englund because he was such a great guy, mm-hmm. and still is. Everyone loves Robert Englund. He's still shows up in things, shows up in a lot of horror movies, but this is one of his early major motion picture roles. He done a lot of TV, and he was about to be in V, the miniseries, as the friendly alien who joins the rebels. Robert Englund. We love Robert Englund. From everyone's way everyone talks about him, just the friendliest guy in the world. Seems like this is a cast of really nice character actors. James mm-hmm. Ferrantino, who played Sheriff Dan, would go on to die kind of destitute, a lot of emotional problems, a lot of substance abuse problems. Also, he ended up stalking Frank Sinatra's daughter. And then he had a really weird...
Great.
He had a really weird interview that's quoted on his IMDb page. I'm going to find this just because it's like, what is this? This quote says, "There are people in this business that for years said, he's an alcoholic, he's a drunk, he stalked Tina Sinatra, and the clamps were put on me in many ways." And I'm like, wait a minute. Unless you're making big box office, they're going to kill you. And I'm like, let's roll it back to the whole stalked Tina Sinatra thing, because you seem to be brushing that one aside. I'm like, that's not a substance abuse problem, my friend. You stalked Tina Sinatra. I think that your career hitting the rocks, maybe that's okay. Like, maybe you don't get to act anymore because you stalked Tina Sinatra, Frank Sinatra's daughter, who wasn't Nancy Sinatra. Maybe that was a problem there. But yeah, he died. So, but it seems like other than that, most of the people in this movie were some pretty decent chaps. A lot of character actors who just wanted to work in horror, who wanted to do a movie with Gary Sherman, who people liked working with. Gary Sherman makes this movie. It comes out. It doesn't do great. Like we said, it's edited all to heck. It becomes known as a video nasty in the UK, so people in the UK can't really get their hands on it for a while unless they get their hands on illegal copies of it. He goes on to do the movie Vice Squad, which is kind of the movie he always wanted to make, which is a incredibly grim crime film. He does, as we said, The Mysterious 2, a TV movie. He does Wanted Dead or Alive, which is a semi-remake of the 1950s Western Wanted Dead or Alive, except it's about a descendant of the main character who's a bounty hunter. And he does a lot of TV. He does Poltergeist 3.
Talk about Poltergeist 3.
We don't talk about Poltergeist 3. He had to make some hard choices with that movie.
He didn't make any hard choices. He was forced to do something he didn't want to do.
And he still, I think he still works. He did a new commentary track for the Blu-ray of Dead and Buried. He's done commentary tracks for all of his movies, I think, that have been re-released for Blue Underground. And you know what? He just seems like the kind of guy who just loves making movies, loves working with people, loves telling stories, and has a lot of respect for the people he works with. It just gave me a lot of respect for Gary Sherman, just a guy who just never really became a famous filmmaker, but just desperately wanted to make the movies he wanted to make. That's Dead and Buried.
Gary
I really
Sherman,
like this movie.
You went from the guy that my dad had no idea who you were, as he said several times in our intro, mm-hmm. yep. to a well-respected man.
I really like... Really like Gary Sherman. He got to start making music videos before music videos were a thing. That's a big part of his life. He started out making short films for bands, and that's what grew into. He made documentaries and stuff, and then he started making movies. The music for this was by Joe Renzetti, who had done the music for the Elvis movie, did Poltergeist 3, did the original Child's Play. Joe Renzetti's interesting. He does a lot of electronic music. And if you search him on Spotify, you'll find some really wild electronic music out there. But he did an album of The Who's Tommy, but all electronic music. That is one of the most hilariously bad things I've ever heard in my life. Go on Spotify, search Joe Renzetti, The Who's Tommy. And it's like early electronic music. So it's like Pinball Wizard. It's all... Because it's electronic music before there was a lot of just easy synth. It was I'm plugging things into things and flipping switches to make electronic music. It's gross and I love it. And I'm going to listen to it all Halloween. So yeah.
I'm going to listen to Wolfman
Of course I'm listening
Batman,
to
Batman, Frankenstein,
but that's
and
a 2.5-minute-long song. The rest of my Halloween will be The Who's Tommy as performed by Joe Renzetti. Terrible album. Everyone needs to pick up a copy of it. So yes, Dead and Buried, two big thumbs up. Two big thumbs up. Big thumbs up. I have the Four big thumbs up from all of us. I have the Blue Underground Blu-ray. It's a brilliant transfer from the most original sources they could find. Gary Sherman worked on this one as well. There's four audio commentary tracks on this. One with Gary Sherman and the guy from Blue Underground. One with Ron Shusett, who wrote the original screenplay, and his wife, who plays the waitress in this movie. It's her only acting role.
Nice.
But she's like, yeah, I'm going to do the commentary with Ron. The DP, the director of photography, who does an amazing job of this movie, does the commentary track. And Troy Howarth and Nathaniel Thompson, film historians. I love Troy Howarth's audio commentaries. This thing is worth the price of admission just for Troy Howarth, but also Gary Sherman. And these are new commentary tracks. They're recorded like over Zoom, like during COVID. Like, this is like, we are recording this in 2021. These are new. There's also an interview with Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, the author who did the novelization of the movie. There's just like a 15-minute interview with her where they're like, how'd you write this novelization? And she's like, I got a call asking if I wanted to do this. And I was like, sure, I write horror. But if you get a chance to read any of her vampire stuff, it's apparently a very spicy, erotic, romantic vampire stuff that is like supposed to be really good. Like 20 volumes of this one vampire story. She talks about her work. She's like this. Like, this is, she's like just a fiery, like, author. She has a lot to say about the industry. She's pretty cool. There's a whole documentary on it about the locations, about, there's just like 30 minutes of, they had a camera set up on set, and they're like, anyone can pick up the camera and film. Anyone wants to pick up the camera and shoot footage backstage. So there's a 30-minute, like, of just Gary Sherman and I can't remember who the other person is, just narrating the silent footage. They're like, oh, there's so-and-so. Oh, look, this was the day we shot this. Oh, look, I like that guy. He was really nice. It's just, it's charming. Yeah, pick up Dead and Buried. And it also comes with a CD of the soundtrack is included. So if you want the music to Dead and Buried, it's on here. And it comes with a booklet. It's pretty cool. What did Guillermo del Toro think and have to say? Why does he like this movie so much?
Special effects.
It's gory. He says it finds the beauty in death. Like, the beauty in all this, like, of this, like, horrific view. But it's filmed so beautifully. But also, this is one of three movies that Guillermo del Toro saw when he was a kid that he used. This is amazing. That he used a fake mustache to get into. He bought, a makeup set. And it came with a fake mustache that he would apply. And he went to go see three horror films. I didn't write down the other two, but this is one of them that he saw. And then he was like, I don't think I was actually fooling anyone. I think they just felt bad for the fat kid with the fake mustache. And we're like, go in. You could go see the movie. If you go to YouTube, look up Trailers from Hell, Dead and Buried. It's narrated by Guillermo del Toro. It's just an interview, like a three minutes with Guillermo del Toro talking about Dead and Buried and the trailer for Dead and Buried, and how he was a little fat kid with a fake mustache going to see this movie. And they were just like, just go. Like, we're not going to, you put on the mustache, kid. We're going to let you in the movie. But yeah, he thinks this is a beautiful film. He thinks it's amazingly made. It's shocking. The special effects are outstanding. If you see this movie for no other reason, see it for the fake puppet people. They look so real.
They're very good.
They are. They are very good.
I'm the queen of understatement. Let's be real here.
Yes, for you are the queen of the understatement. And speaking of understatements, what is the next movie in Guillermo del Toro's ecstasy of influence? What are we going to watch?
Poltergeist 3. Poltergeist 3.
It's not Poltergeist 3, unfortunately. It is Polish filmmakers Andrzej Żuławski, I don't know how to properly say his name, Possession, starring Sam Neill and Isabel Anjani. And this is another one of those movies that I am so nervous about watching, because even though it's considered one of the greatest films of its time and of its genre, it's I believe going to be very uncomfortable to watch with my child. I think it's another one of those movies.
Are we gonna have to watch it together in person then?
I don't know,
because that's how we've done all of the other movies that have been uncomfortable to watch.
If possible, but honestly, oh boy, I don't know. This could be like the other movies that are uncomfortable to watch, where we're like, oh, this wasn't as bad as we thought. But I'm looking at the reviews, and everyone is just giving it 5 stars across the board. This is a 4.5 to 5 star movie that people are just like.
Speaking of movies that are uncomfortable to watch, I was yesterday in class. You want to know whose name got brought up?
Roman Polanski?
No.
I mean, that's uncomfortable to watch. Well, whose?
Grandier. Father Grandier's.
Oh, really?
From
in
the
what
devils.
Context? From the
In
devils.
The context of the witch trials.
Yeah, because you're studying the European witch trials. Yeah. Did you bring up that you've seen the devils?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
Because I was like, oh, this is not necessary. But I did, I was like, hey, I know that guy.
Yeah. Oh, so you did, like, spill some knowledge.
No, it was, we were doing a workshop, so we were all doing stuff on our own. But I was like, hey, that's the guy.
You want to hear me talk about it? There's a whole episode.
Yep.
It's Del Toro time. That's awesome. No, Grandier is, that's a fascinating, I mean, historically speaking, this is a fascinating period of time. Not the most fun. I am currently reading the novel, Between Two Fires. It's set in the 1300s. It's about the plague, but it involves a lot of it's a historical horror that people kept recommending to me, saying if you want to be upset and disturbed by a horror novel, read Between Two Fires. And I am not upset or disturbed yet, but I am captivated by the novel. So that's my Halloween recommendation.
My Halloween recommendation is the witch trial that I read and then sent you a really condensed version of.
Whose trial was that? Do you remember?
Yesterday. What was his name? I have the paper somewhere in my bag. I can talk about that afterwards, though.
Okay.
And we can just say the name, but well, yeah.
I will post to Twitter who you are talking about so that everyone can go read this horrifyingly sad witch trial transcript if they want to.
All right. Are we signing off now? Is this a signing off? Is this a
Yeah, because I've got to go get ready for listeners? Apple picking.
Ew.
It's apple picking day. I was hoping it would be cool. It's supposed to be very warm today. I was hoping it would be a nice cold day to go apple picking. It's instead a nice, like, sort of gross.
Have fun with all the bees.
I don't mind the bees so much anymore. They're my friends. Now that I've been stung in the head by
wasps,
I don't care. They can sting my head as much as they want. I know I'll survive.
Just make sure that if you're picking an apple, you check for holes to see if it's infested with wasps.
I will check for apple holes. I don't actually do a whole lot of picking. I just sort of chill and take pictures. I let Alana and Mitzi do the picking because that's not my game, man. I just like to be there. Yes, join us soon for Possession, where we'll see if we're upset by it. And until then, I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.